Okay, do I have you?
I'm here.
Okay. Well, hello, this is Jeff Gaudiosi, and you are on MisplacedStraws.com, where music comes to life. And I'm very excited for the conversation we're about to have. You know, if a movie was made out of my next guest's life, it'd be a lot like Forrest Gump, in that everybody from Edgar Winter to Nelson Mandela would have a cameo in it. He's worked with giants like ELP and Pink Floyd and most notably Michael Jackson himself. He has an amazing new book out now called Rock Doc. Please welcome the Rock Doc himself, Neil Ratner. Welcome, Neil.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. And again, with your story, I mean, I'm quite sure where to start, but we'll find a beginning. New York City, late 60s. You happen to meet Rick Derringer. Is that sort of the kickoff point of the rock part of your story?
Pretty much, although it really started earlier as a kid with my desire to beat out all these rhythms that I had running around my brain, you know, picking up silverware and banging it on the table and hands on the knees. And and so, you know, I had this propensity for rhythm, and I became a drummer, and so, you know, music really started as a kid with my interest in you know, playing the drums and my interest in what was going on. I mean, you know, I'm approaching 70 very rapidly, like in 2 weeks.
Well, happy birthday.
Yeah, thanks. So I grew up, you know, kind of late 50s, and then 60s was really my time. And as you well know, I'm not sure how old you are, but 60s was a pretty hot time in the music
business. Shortly before my time.
Okay. I figured.
Not much, but shortly.
Seems to me I'm older than everyone these days. I don't know. I used to be younger than everyone. Now I'm older than everyone. At any rate, it was a hot time because, you know, British invasion and rock and roll was really just happening. And if you played an instrument, you know, you wanted to be a rock star. That was the way it was, you know, and I was that way. And I took up the drums, and I played in the high school marching band. I played in high school orchestra, and I had a band on the side. So by the time I met Rick Derringer, you know, I had experience in the music business as a striving to be musician, so to speak, having given it up pretty much to go to college when I didn't get a record deal in high school, and pursuing my other dream of becoming a doctor. But you know, that was a very, how shall I say, quirk of fate. You know, it was in between my sophomore and junior year of college at UVM. And I took an apartment in the East Village in the city, and I was in a training program to be an operating room technician. And it was the summer of 69, and I heard music coming from upstairs. And lo and behold, I go in and see this guy with a guitar. Didn't really recognize him. He says, "Hey, I'm Rick Derringer." I said, "Rick Derringer, the McCoys?" He said, "Yeah." And we became fast friends, and he had just started to play in Johnny Winter's band. And it was a heck of a summer, let me tell you. And yeah, that was the transition. Not immediately then, when I left to go back to college at the end of the summer, I had asked Rick to get me a job, ostensibly as a drummer, thinking, you know, I could easily be through with college if Rick gets me into the business. And then about 8 months ago, lo and behold, I get a call from Rick. Starts telling me about Johnny Winter's brother named Edgar, because Rick was playing in Johnny Winter's new band. And thinking he was going to ask me to be the drummer, I got very excited until he said, "We'd like you to be the road manager." And, you know, I didn't know what that was. Wasn't really anxious to do it, but Rick convinced me that it was a good way to get in the business. You never know what will happen, never know who you'll meet. And so I took it, and that started about a 5-6 year odyssey in the business end of the music business.
And now, as you were working with Edgar and the band there, your goal was always to end up behind the drum kit, not to be the tour manager.
Certainly, that was always in the back of my mind. Yeah. As time went on, I realized that was less and less of a possibility. But it was certainly something I always held out hope for.
And then your time with Edgar, that led you to D'Anthony, who was a very well-known manager with some huge clients. And seems as though D kind of taught you sort of the production side of the business.
Well, D taught me a lot of things, actually. Dee was very into touring his groups. So certainly, you know, live performance and production was incredibly important to Dee. But Dee was also the consummate, you know, manager. And he taught me a lot about managing. You know, a road manager is a road manager, but a manager is the manager. And it's really a different job. And so being his assistant, I learned what a manager did. I mean, I knew that anyway, because when I was road manager for Edgar, I actually worked for Edgar's manager, who was Steve Ball, another legendary character who had owned a club in New York, an iconic club in New York called The Scene, which is where like Hendrix and The Doors and many of our classic rock people played for the first time.
Yeah, where it all started.
Yeah, really. But Dee taught me that. And, of course, Dee had incredible connections. You know, back in those days, you know, I used to look at it as if Dee and two other guys pretty much control certainly music business on the East Coast. And the two other guys were Bill Graham, you know, who, of course, was the concert promoter.
Yep. And Fillmore. Frank,
Fillmore, East and West, and Winterland eventually. And then he went into, you know, just concert promotion in general. And Frank Barcelona, another very interesting man. And Frank owned a agency called Premier Talent. And all of the great early rock and roll bands were booked through Frank. And so you had the manager, the promoter, and the agent. And these guys controlled everything. And it was, you know, I mean, being a fly on the wall and getting to go to these meetings and meet these people and get friendly with them and hear the real insight of what they were trying to accomplish and how they were trying to do it. You know, it's fascinating stuff.
Definitely. And especially with a character like D'Anthony, I mean, the stories of him in New York with the, you know,
with the mob.
Is
that what we're talking about, Jeff?
Yeah, you know, so some of the organized crime factions are pretty legendary.
Well, I'll tell you a funny story in relation to that. So I come from a family where my father and my uncle started a business right after World War II. They started a trucking and warehousing business. And as such, they dealt with the Teamsters and the longshoremen, you know, and those were all guys with connections, let's say.
Oh, yes.
And so when I first went to interview with Dee for the job, and he started to ask me my family background, and I told him the kind of family I came from, he said, okay, you're hired.
You're in.
You got your
And you know, the lessons you learned from Dee and everything, that sort of led you to your first really big gig with Emerson, Lake and Palmer. What was it like working with those guys at the height of their, you know, prowess?
You know, at the height of their popularity, particularly in Europe, they were like the Beatles. I mean, you know, we could sell out major arenas, we could sell out major stadiums and people around the hotel. I mean, everything you would think of from, you know, superstar status, that's what these guys had. And, you know, it was a real, another education for me, you know, going from a tour bus to a Learjet, for example. But, you know, it presented a whole different set of problems and possibilities. And, you know, I had to get used to the fact that I was now working with a group with three stars, whereas previously most groups have one front man, whatever. These were three individual people, each a star in their own right. And that made going on the road with them quite challenging, because everybody wanted to be the star, but obviously everybody always wasn't the star. And so, you know, you had to be a bit of a psychologist and a bit of a babysitter and everything else. But it was a great experience. You know, I was a young guy and I moved to London, you know, in 1972 or something. And it was really exciting and terrific.
And, you know, it's funny. I don't know if you've seen the Play It Loud exhibit at the Met that the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame has done with all different instruments and things like that, and they have one of Keith Emerson's keyboards.
Keyboard,
with the knife still
I've seen the knife still in it.
Yeah, the knife is actually still in. So,
you want to hear a story about the knife?
Of course.
All right. So, one of my jobs as the road manager, tour manager for Emerson, Lake and Palmer, was carrying Keith's knives. Now, back in the day, obviously, you could do that, and there was no TSA or anything, you know, so people weren't freaking out about that. But the story of one knife, of his main knife, this, like, Bowie knife that he used to mostly stab, and I wonder if it's the same knife. That knife was given to him by a roadie from the Knife. Now, that roadie went on to become quite famous, and his name was Lemmy.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. And
he was
and
a roadie
that
for
didn't
the
even
knife.
Make the book.
No, that didn't even make the book. That's right. He was a roadie for the knife, and when he left the knife to form MC5?
Motorhead.
Motorhead. When he went, that's right, of course. Similar groups. But when he went to form his own group, he wanted Keith to have something special, and one of his prized possessions was his knife. And so I gave Keith the knife, and Keith used that knife with the LP to stab his piano.
That's a great story. I wonder if it is the one that's at the
Rockall
exhibit.
I don't know. I don't know.
That up.
I know I had that knife in my possession many, many times, so maybe I'd recognize it. So I have to go and see the exhibit. I know it's there, and I want to see it. I just haven't gotten there yet.
It's fantastic. Definitely recommend it. But
I'm sure.
So then, you know, after ELP, you formed your own company, and that led you to probably the big as it gets to Pink Floyd on the Dark Side of the Moon tour. How did all that come about?
That was another quirk of fate, as they say. Yeah. You know, so you could believe in coincidence, you can believe in karma, believe what you like. I had a girlfriend at UVM, and she's a very interesting person, too. Her name was Putty Watts. Her name is Putty Watts. Still around, of course. And she, when I went and moved to London to work with Emerson, Lake & Palmer, I was there for about a month, maybe a little longer, and I got a phone call. And it was a surprising phone call because it was Putty. And she told me, hey, I heard you're in London. I moved to London. I got married. Great. So I want you to meet my husband. He's in the music business. Blah, 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 blah. Okay. So I go and I meet him, and it's a guy named Peter Watts. Well, what does Peter Watts do? Well, Peter Watts had been the road manager for the Pretty Things, and then he became the road manager / chief sound technician for the Pink Floyd, and then he just focused on sound for Pink Floyd. Mm-hmm. So he was the chief sound technician for Pink Floyd when I met him. And we, of course, hit it off famously. And when I had this idea for an all-in-one production company, which was a new idea in the music business at that time, you know, all these groups were using multiple companies, a sound company, a lighting company, a trucking company, a this or that. And in the age of before cell phones and analog computers, it all got very complicated. And so my concept was this all-in-one company, like a circus, everything under one roof. When I told Peter, he thought it was a fabulous idea. Now, I'm not a sound guy or a lighting guy. I was more an organizational guy, you know, put all the pieces together, et cetera, handle the money, whatever. So I needed technical people, and he said, I got these friends, man. They got this incredible sound and lighting company, and they're splitting apart. And the one guy, Jim Morris, he's keeping all the equipment. He's looking for a partner. You should take him into your company, and that he's your technical guy. And so I did, and we formed this company, and we started to solicit business. I was out on an ELP tour because I went back to them, and I said, all right, I got this company now. What do you want to do? Tell me what your next production is going to be, and I'll create it for you. And we did this incredible thing. I mean, Greg Lake sat there, and he said, well, you know, we play in these impersonal big venues every night, and it's very disorienting and blah, blah, blah. Wouldn't it be nice if we had our own theater? I said, what do you mean? He said, well, let's build a theater every night.
with full theatrical curtaining, a proscenium arch. We'll put all the lights and sounds within it. It'll be like our own theater, and we'll feel very comfortable, and it'll be great. And I actually did that for him. It turned out to be a bit of a nightmare. I mean, it was 60 foot by 30 foot by 30 foot high.
Mm-hmm.
Took us hours to put it up and take it down. And nobody had ever done that before.
Right.
Proscenium Arch Theater. But now it's kind of standard fare. At any rate, I was on that tour. And Peter called me up, and I could tell by his voice that something was wrong. What's the matter, Peter? Well, we're out on the English tour. You know, we've been working on this album called Dark Side of the Moon, not finished yet. But we decided that we would try and do it as a full concert production. Didn't come out right. I don't have enough equipment. I want this to be true quadraphonic sound. Arthur Max, the lighting guy, he wants to be the first. Blah, blah, blah. He went on and on. Okay, so what do you want? You got the equipment. Your company has got to be a part of this. I was like blown away because Floyd, I never even went to Peter or asked him because they were notorious for doing everything in a self-contained way. But he said, I spoke to Steve O'Rourke, the manager. He agrees. This is going to be special. And so when I got off that tour, I went and met with Steve O'Rourke, and we came up with a deal. And my company joined the next leg, which was the American leg, in March of 73, right when the album came out.
And did you, being in the middle of it, did you know how big that was going to become and just sort of the history that that would create that tour?
No. You know, I've been asked that question before, mm-hmm. and it's really interesting. You know, when you're in the heat of it, mm-hmm. you don't know. You know it's a great tour. You know it's a great show. You don't know what it's going to be 10 years later or 20 years later.
How
it's going to
be
looked upon.
Yeah.
Exactly. And don't forget, prior to the Dark Side of the Moon, the Floyd were not that huge.
Right.
You know, think about their previous albums mm-hmm. and where they were. They were an ELP.
Very
right?
true at that point, yeah.
You know, it was Dark Side of the Moon that really pushed them over the top to a certain mm-hmm. extent. So, yeah, it was a great tour. This was an amazing band. We were doing incredible things. Knew it was great. But again, you know, as I like to say, it's a lot different putting on a pair of headphones and smoking a joint and listening to the Dark Side of the Moon album than having to be on the road and be responsible for the production.
Right. Yeah, you're not really kicking back and enjoying the show.
Not so much.
Yeah,
no.
Yeah.
Not so much.
And that's around the time your career began to switch gears. You went back to the medical field. You went through school. You started your practice. What led to that kind of dramatic shift there?
After the Dark Side of the Moon tour, Peter and I were so successful with the combined equipment, mm-hmm. and the Floyd weren't going out for a while. So we asked Steve if we could, like, solicit business and do a couple of tours mm-hmm. until they were ready to go out again. He said yes. So we did a few more tours. We did Three Dog Night. We did T-Rex. And then, you know, back in the day, rock and roll was sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Mm. That you know, that phrase was a very real condition of life. And so I sort of got burnt out. And I ended up with kidney stones in a hospital in London. And this movie came on about, you know, medical students going to their residency and becoming country doctors, called Not as a Stranger. And, you know, it just hit me. You know, I had this epiphany, and I said, you know, I'm not going to be a drummer. I've accomplished everything I set out to do in the business end. Maybe it's time now to look at my other dream, which I had had since childhood,
mm-hmm.
of becoming a doctor. And so right then and there, I made the decision. My partner was more than happy to take the company, sold the company to him. And off I went, hoping that I'd be able to accomplish what I thought I could accomplish. And it was not an easy task. You know,
now,
I had
how old were you at this time?
I was about, 25 maybe.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I was about 25. Mm-hmm. And so I was certainly older, and I had to go back to college. You know, I just walked out of UVM, mm-hmm. dismissed below scholarship. So I had a bit of a time getting a college to accept me, particularly in a pre-med program.
Yeah.
And even though I did quite well with a 3.3 or something average, I couldn't get into an American medical school. You know, I'm sure you know, Jeff, medical schools passed present and future will always be ridiculously hard to get into.
Yes.
And being older and the discontinuous education and the music business experience was not an asset for me. So basically, I couldn't get into an American medical school. But fortunately, there were foreign medical schools around the world that were very aware of the situation in America and had sort of opened their doors to American students. And I checked around to see which one would be suitable. Guadalajara, Mexico seemed to be the best option. Most everybody was getting back into the American system. I knew a little Spanish, although I knew I would have to know a lot of Spanish to go there. I chose Guadalajara, spent 3 months in a language school to get proficient, got married, and then my wife and I spent our honeymoon driving from New York to Guadalajara, Mexico, where we spent the next 4 years. When I finished that whole thing, I had to do a year of unpaid internship to get back into the American system. Wasn't sure what kind of doctor I wanted to be. Did 2 years of surgical residency thinking I wanted to be a surgeon, but then realized that probably anesthesia was a better choice. Did an anesthesia residency and became an anesthesiologist. 10 years.
And it's funny because you can actually sort of compare it to what you did with Circus Entertainment, where you found a new way of running the business by bringing it in the office rather than into the operating room. You know,
absolutely. You know, I mean, after 10 years of all that training, five of which were in hospitals, I really didn't want to be in a hospital anymore. And that's a difficult thing if you're an anesthesiologist, because most anesthesiologists are part of hospital-based groups. So I looked around to see if there was anything else that I could do. You know, and some guys were going into pain, and some guys were becoming intensivists in the intensive care unit. But I noticed that doctors really wanted to operate in their office. And in Europe, they were doing it extensively, and in some parts of America, not so much in New York City. And so I thought, you know, with the kind of level of experience that I had, because I had concentrated in my residency on the lesser cases, I always found it fascinating to be able to take drugs, mix them together, and put somebody in a semi-conscious state where you could actually inject local anesthesia and do surgery on someone. And so that was sort of my area of expertise, and I knew I could do that in an office. Even though most anesthesiologists shied away from that because the drugs were not good for office-based surgery, nor were the monitors. And everybody was afraid, you know, you go into an office, the office is not equipped well, the drugs are bad, and what do you do if you get into trouble? And
right.
So nobody had taken that leap. And I said, well, I'll do it then. I'll be the guy to take the leap. And I did. And, you know, and I was one of the first to actually devote myself. From the day I left residency, I never worked in a hospital. 20 years, I created the practice of office-based anesthesia. And was pretty successful. So,
and that the success at that and the idea behind that is what led you to interacting with Michael Jackson at first.
Absolutely. When I decided that this is what I wanted to do, I had to pick a doctor to approach who I thought would buy into my whole plan here. And, you know, I was having trouble choosing that surgeon. I had already decided that probably cosmetic reconstructive surgery was the best place for me to go. They had the kind of patients who didn't want to be in hospitals. They had the kind of surgeries that could easily be done in the office, and they had the money to make their offices like mini hospitals.
Right.
So I figured those are the guys I need to approach, but which one? And I was sitting in the doctor's lounge about 2 months before the end of my residency, and I read a little piece in the New York Post, the gossip column of one of the local New York papers, which mentioned that Michael Jackson had gone to see his favorite cosmetic surgeon in New York, Dr. So-and-so. And I realized that I knew that guy, sort of. He was in the hospital I was in. I had seen him many times. And I thought, that's the guy I should approach. And so I approached him. He bought into my idea. And 8 years later, Michael came back to the office.
And, you know, of real friendship developed between the two of you. You know, reading your book, you get into a lot of it. You know, you really did kind of look out for him, you know, and definitely had his interests in hand as you were, you know, helping him out. And he originally was with the sleeping issue. That seemed to be his main thing.
Yes and no. First, to address the first part of your question, you know, I'm Michael became my friend. Yes, I was his personal physician. He reached out to me and asked me to help him with problems he was having medically. But more than that, I also became his friend. And you know, I have a very serious view of friendship. You know, a friend really means that you're a friend, that, you know, someone that you should be able to tell good and bad to, and somebody that you should be able to, you know, be with under all circumstances. So, yeah, of course, you know, I looked out for him as I would any other friend, and I do for my friends. And when a friend reached out and said, hey, you know, I'm having problems here, can you help me? You know, it was incumbent upon me as a friend and, of course, as a physician to try and come up with some solution. And the problem was more than just sleep. We became friendly mainly over late-night phone calls. You know, after the first procedure, I did a little procedure, and we had talked on the phone. I saw him in the office, and we hit it off. You know, he knew that I was a music guy. I looked different. I had a ponytail and an earring. And so we hit it off, but when he left the office, I never knew if I'd ever see him again, you know, or talk to him again. I didn't have his phone number or anything. And then, lo and behold, a couple of weeks later, I get a phone call, 4 o'clock in the morning, which I didn't usually get. I got nervous, or a patient had to go to the hospital. I didn't know what was going on. And, you know, hey, Rod, what are you doing? I was like, Michael? And so we became friendly over the course of late-night phone calls for about a year. And then he started spending a lot of time in New York because he was supposed to do a couple of concerts at the Beacon Theater. Mm-hmm. And they were going to be filmed by HBO. And Michael had a problem. I mean, first of all, yes, he had a serious sleep problem, which many doctors had tried to treat in the classical way, sleep medication.
Mm-hmm.
By the time I met Michael, he was not sleeping and addicted to sleep medication, which is not an uncommon story with people with sleep disorders. But more than that, this was not necessarily an everyday thing. It was particularly intense before he had something like a concert or a video shoot or something like that. And then it got out of control, and he wouldn't eat and he wouldn't drink. And so it was worse than just not sleeping in that he was, you know, at that point when he reached out to me, he was severely dehydrated, his nutrition was awful, he looked terrible, his color was awful, and on top of that, he didn't sleep at all. So as a friend and physician, I came up with a solution that I felt comfortable with in my hands as a temporary stopgap measure to help him through these times and hopefully convert him to something, you know, better lifestyle kind of choices later on.
Well, and I think one of the important things you just said was, you know, you felt comfortable with it in your hands, because the treatment was the propofol, which eventually years later under someone else's hands kind of led to, you know, Michael's ultimate death. What what was your thought with the propofol, knowing, you know, how strong it is and knowing his addiction issues?
Well, propofol was, okay, remember I said to you the reason that anesthesiologists didn't want to do office surgery were bad drugs and bad monitors. One of the things that made office surgery and anesthesia in general safer was propofol. It's a miracle drug, quite honestly, and a remarkable advance in the field of anesthesiology. I, as you can imagine, when I started my practice, was desperately looking for things that would make my life easier and safer. I became aware of propofol before it was ever FDA approved in America, because I would read all the anesthesia journals. I wanted to see how people were doing office surgery around the world to see what I could, you know, co-opt in my own practice to make things safer and better. And I started to read about propofol. And I mean, that the articles and the dynamics of this particular medication were absolutely incredible. So as soon as the FDA approved it, I ordered it very quickly. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, I introduced it to some of the surgeons for the first time. They had never seen it. And there's a funny story in the book where I'm in an office and I give the propofol, and of course most of our anesthetic medications are clear liquids. Propofol is a milky white liquid. And I put it in the line and the surgeon starts going crazy. Well, what's the matter? What's the matter?
That.
He said, it's contaminated. Look. And I said, no, calm down. I had to give him a little in service on what the new drug was. But so by the time Michael reached out to me, many years later, I had used propofol literally thousands and thousands of times. And I was certainly an expert in its use, and I understood the dynamics of it. And again, I used it every day for 7, 8, 9 cases over the course of years. So when Michael reached out to me, I felt that could be part of a solution with fluids, nutrition, electrolytes, things like that, to get him in a better shape for what he needed to do. I created this out of my expertise, and I explained it very carefully to Michael. Obviously, he didn't get the message that, you know, this was okay in my hands. But, you know, I'm an anesthesiologist. You know, I was very well-trained, well-versed in the administration of anesthesia and the administration of medications. You know, it was never done in any other way than as if we were in an operating room somewhere with full monitoring, with emergency equipment, et cetera, et cetera.
I,
from what I've read, I don't think that was the case at the end.
Yeah, it doesn't seem it. And, you know, you've, one of the things I think that comes across about Michael in your book is that although he, you know, had these friendships, he was always, you know, looking for, in addition to a friend, someone else who could do something for him. So if you wouldn't use the propofol in the way he wanted to, well, then he'll go find somebody else on the side that will.
Well, yeah, no, that's very common with celebrities. You know, they want what they want, and they want it now. And if you can't do it, we'll do it. You know, this was a little bit different in that, you know, I think, I was with Michael the last time he ever performed, which was actually at the 9/11 concert at RFK Stadium. He hadn't performed publicly in many, many years. And I know he had to be incredibly uptight, nervous. They were pushing him. And I think he just got this idea in his head. You know, whether rats available or not, I must find somebody to do this because I'll never be able to accomplish it without. And it wasn't really an addiction. When propofol first came out, there were no reports of addiction. And for many, many, many years, there were no reports of addiction, and it was judged to be a non-addictive drug. Of course, anesthesiologists changed that. You know, drug addiction is an occupational hazard of anesthesiology. And so anesthesiologists will try anything and everything. And so all of a sudden, you know, there were reports of anesthesiologists who had addictive problems with propofol. But still, even to this day, I don't think you find too many reports of people being addicted to propofol. So I don't think Michael was addicted to propofol per se, although after the 60 days that he got it at the end, he probably was.
Yes.
But certainly he felt the psychological need to have that treatment to be able to perform correctly.
And again, you talking about your friendship with him, you guys spent a lot of time in Africa. You spent a lot of time with Nelson Mandela with Michael. What was it like, you know, being around somebody like Mandela at that time?
Mandela was it's one of the most amazing experiences. With all of my experiences, you know, certainly the time with Mandela stands out. I first got to meet him on the history tour when we played South Africa. He was the president of South Africa. And I had told Michael before we ever went to South Africa, look, man, this guy's my hero.
if I could just shake his hand, get a picture, don't worry. And, you know, I talk about it in the book, you know, where Mandela came into the dressing room after the first concert we did in Cape Town and went down the line, and I got to meet him and shake his hand. And then, unbelievably, Michael called me down for private pictures with him and Mandela. And then a few years later, you know, we had done some concerts, charity concerts, half of the money going to Mandela. And as a 50th birthday present to me, Michael called me one day and said, "Hey, I want to give you a birthday present," which was an amazing thing anyway, because as a Jehovah's Witness, that was
exactly.
Not his name.
Yep.
But I said, "You don't have to give me anything." He said, no. "Remember, we raised the money." And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, you're going to South Africa with me. We're going to give Mandela the check." I said, "Wow." And we did. I mean, flew us there first class in a suite. And this was had nothing to do with being a doctor. This was a friend. And I got to spend an afternoon with Michael and Mandela, Mandela's wife, and Michael had his kids. It was quite incredible. And many years later, when I started a charity, Mandela helped finance the first project. So, you know, the whole Mandela thing was really an unbelievable thing. And Michael's relationship with Mandela was unbelievable. And I hope I captured that a little bit in the book.
Oh, definitely.
Because it was almost like a father-son. Mm-hmm. You know, there was so much respect back and forth. And just being around the two of them, either individually or together, was really a unique experience that I'll never forget.
And over the course of time, you spent about 8 years or so with Michael. And, you know, I don't think any conversation about Michael Jackson could happen without bringing up some of the issues that came out against him.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Leaving Neverland documentary and stuff like that. And you mentioned early on in your relationship with him that, you know, he introduced you to a young boy that was the son of one of his security guards that was kind of with him, and it raised an eyebrow with you. Did you see anything that would, you know, make you think twice about some of the allegations that came out against him after? You know, was there anything that worried you in your time with him?
Well, you know, when I first went on tour with him and the little boy appeared, it freaked me out a little bit because, you know, I was aware of some of the allegations previously, which didn't involve these kids that we're talking about, you know, these young men believing Neverland. You know, it was some of the earlier allegations. And I was just surprised that there was a little boy around. And I talked to Michael about it, and I talked to security about it, and they said, "Hey, you know, it's such and such his son, they know, parents know, it's cool." And I talked to Michael about it, and, you know, he and I often talk about things like that. I mean, he just saw it differently than others. You know, Michael was very hung up about his lost childhood.
Right.
He liked to relate to kids because of the innocence of childhood, and he felt that they were more honest and real than the adults that were around him. And even when I would say, "Yeah, but you're a 50-year-old man," or however old he was, 45-year-old man, and society doesn't accept it, he said, "No, well, they're wrong. There's nothing here. It's innocent." You know, certainly I had my eyes wide open after that incident.
Mm-hmm.
And by the end of the tour, I realized that it was all bullshit, you know, that you know, these guys were like brothers or cousins or whatever, that people really did have it wrong. And I'm an anesthesiologist. An anesthesiologist are great observers. And I would not have tolerated that. I mean, I would have had to stop it. I would have had to make sure it never happened again. I couldn't be associated with anything like that. And I have to say, in the 8 years that I was with Michael, nothing. Was he a man-child? Yes. But did any of that kind of, you know, sexual behavior go on? No. Not that I was aware of or saw. And if I had been aware of it or saw it or even, you know, thought in the slightest way that something was happening, you know, my actions would have been much different than what they were. So, you know, and I feel badly now that he isn't here to defend himself.
Mm-hmm. Well,
know,
I always think that's the biggest.
He gives such a one-sided portrayal without any kind of rebuttal at all.
Mm-hmm.
And people should assume that that's true because they said it. You know, we live in a world of fake news. When people just say whatever they want to say,
That's for sure.
Yeah, really.
And then as you kind of moved on a bit, you're very open in the book about your legal troubles on an insurance fraud that was a pretty high-profile case in New York at the time.
So, Jeff, as a lawyer, did you get a kick out of that whole thing?
I was reading that with interest. I'm like, that's for sure. And I definitely applaud you for being so open about it and everything that went on with it. And it ended up with you doing a jail sentence. What do you think was the biggest lesson you took from the whole thing?
Ooh, the biggest lesson I took from the whole experience or being in jail?
Both.
The biggest lesson I took from the whole experience is don't think, analyze your situations very carefully. You know, I was blinded by the light, so to speak. You know, I knew what the surgeon was doing was wrong. On the other hand, I sort of agreed with him that every woman had a right to have a baby, and the insurance company should at least pay for one cycle.
Right. There's the moral question and the legal question.
There's the So what do they say?
Always side with
the wrong thing for the right reason. And I deluded myself into believing that they were his patients, his diagnosis. And I was just a contract player. I was just an outsourced guy who came in and gave anesthesia. There was no question that I wasn't overbilling. That was never in question.
Right.
Or that I gave good anesthesia.
Mm-hmm.
That was never in question. But what I never thought about was the fact that on my anesthesia record, I was omitting the fact that patients were on fertility medications, which would have been the giveaway.
Yeah.
And so I was as complicit as everybody else, and I realized that. And, you know, looking back retrospectively, don't delude yourself into thinking things are cool when you know in your heart they're not. That's the message I got out of the experience. The message I got out of prison was, first of all, we're all human beings, and we should treat each other exactly the same as human beings. There's no different. You go into prison, you know, I'm not a big shot Upper East Side doctor. I'm not Michael Jackson's doctor. I'm not the producer of the Pink Floyd. I'm number whatever number I was. And I'm the same as everybody else. And that's a real humbling lesson. That's number one.
Yeah.
Number two, I was very saddened by the system. The prison system upset me. And what upset me was I was in prison mostly with many, many Black, Hispanic, ethnic minority, poor people. People who had gotten caught up in the only life that they seemed to have an option to do because they had so little opportunity. They had so little access to services. They were treated so poorly. And the way our system is, it was sort of designed to either keep them there or get them back there. And I felt very badly about that. And, you know, I spent a lot of time, you know, with all the other inmates just trying to, you know, give whatever wisdom and encouragement I could. And so that was a very humbling experience. And then the last thing I got out of it is patience.
A lot of time on your hands.
Yeah. A lot of time on your hands. And as they used to say in the joint, do the time, don't let the time do you.
Yeah. And then as your legal troubles were ending, Michael's were starting up again with another trial, another child molestation trial. And that seems to be sort of where you guys kind of lost contact. You know, was there ever a period in those few years between, you know, 2003 and ultimately his death in 2009 where either of you reached out, or did it just kind of end at that point?
Yes and no. You know, the last time I heard from Michael about 2 weeks after I went to jail, he called my wife to see if I was okay, which was incredible, and I really appreciated that. when I got out, as you said, I had my own problems to deal with, and he was starting to deal with his. There was no benefit in us talking. I was a convicted felon now. We did communicate a little bit through third parties. You know, I knew some people, he knew some people, and we, you know, would say hello or hi, whatever. But there was no direct communication after that, no.
And, again, all of this is in your book, which is just amazing. It's called Rock Doc. You can order it off of your website. I assume it's up on Amazon and stuff like that. I actually ordered a signed copy off your website, so I highly recommend
that. I know, and
that.
I appreciate that, Jeff. And people can do that still. You know, if you go to my website, neilratnerrockdoc.com, there's a section that will say buy the book. And if you buy it, let me know how you want me to autograph it. It would be my pleasure. Otherwise, Amazon, all formats, including an audiobook, which I did myself, all the voices, and it's kind of a kick if you're into that kind of thing.
And now, aside from the book, and as we spoke, you know, before the interview started, to me, you have, like, the best Facebook page on there with all of your stories and video. It's amazing. You know, what else are you up to? You know, anything
that's turned into a big deal, actually. The whole, you know, Rock Doc persona, and I'm trying to create a Rock Doc persona and brand it. And as you said, I tell these Facebook stories every day for the past 5 years, stories about my experiences, my friends' experiences, and just cool stories about old rock and roll and songs and videos. And I'm on Twitter and Instagram. And basically, you know, we're developing that. I also have a little radio show on Radio Woodstock, WDST up here. I live in Woodstock. And I do This Week in Rock at 3 o'clock on Saturday and Sunday. And we're developing all this into possibly a podcast, a syndicated radio show, something. So this is going to expand out into something more. And we're working on that now. I hope to get out there and talk. I have a lot of good stories and a lot of good lessons that I would like to share with people. And just see where we go with it. You know, you spoke about a movie. I have been approached, and we're working.
Oh, really?
Yes, a few times, actually. We turned down a couple of documentaries.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't like where they were going with it, but I'm working with an English guy right now that seems to have some potential, and the story seems to lend itself to film. So I don't know. In a couple of years, maybe you'll see it up on the big screen somewhere.
Well, yeah, it's been amazing actually getting to talk to you, especially after all these years of reading your Facebook pages and your book, to actually have the conversation. It's just amazing. So I thank
you. Well, it's great for me to talk to somebody who's aware of all these things, and I really appreciate it, Jeff, so thank you.
And please keep in touch. Let me know if you do get the podcast or anything from that to the film going. Let me know. We'll get the word out there for you. And,
sure will.
Again, thank you so much, and have a great day.
You too, Jeff, and thanks for the time. It's been a great call.
Thank you. Bye.
Okay, bye.